we are back with episode 378 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I hear confession is good for the soul, so I will confess that the Baltimore Homicide Department can now officially run rings around the CIA.
And this is Gary from Jacksonville, and wow, I never realized that Haven was such a deep sea diving mecca.
And here we are with Homeland, the show that that does for the CIA what Grey's Anatomy does for all of medicine. Okay.
Ooh.
Yeah. All right. Wow. We're going to be going to all kinds of depths in this particular episode. But first, Edmund, can you maybe give us some non-disclosure here, or disclosure, as the case may be?
Absolutely. As always, we will discuss absolutely anything that might have gone on in these episodes, whether we like it or not, and that means you will most definitely be spoiled. But we've tried to wait a week or so we certainly hope you've had the chance to catch up.
That's right, and speaking of catching up, Gary and I have a little catching up to do on a little show called Haven, so why don't we go ahead and run the first promo.
Someone who can crush things from a distance.
My ears pop.
The Troubles are destroying this town.
You agreed to execute a plan.
The only people you seem to be protecting are yourselves.
Haven, an original series, all new next Friday at 10.
All right, and that would be Haven, Season 4, Episode 8, Crush. Deadly trouble in the deep sea threatens to crush the entire town. Kinda.
Well, you know, as troubles go, I thought it was a more interesting one than we've had in a while. At least it wasn't lightning or cold or, you know, some of the various other ones that they've come up with over the years.
Well, I think the more important part was that it was one of the deadlier ones we've seen in a long time.
That's true.
If they wanted to really drive home the fact that the troubles are transforming and escalating in some serious ways, this was definitely a way to do it. They only showed a few people dying horribly, but it was really used to imply the dozens of other people that were haplessly getting in harm's way with absolutely no way of really avoiding it. And I was just kind of a little stunned by just how far they took that. I mean, certainly Haven has never been the kind of place that you want to go for a walk around the park because, well, half the park will probably try to kill you. But in this case, literally, walking in the park was not a good idea. But this was another episode that was very character-driven. In this case, we had Nathan and Audrey. And I always stumble over calling her Audrey now because quite clearly that's not her name, but who knows what her name actually might be. So I'll just continue. But, you know, they're kind of at a bit of a crossroads. And Nathan's in this really interesting place where, you know, as it's clear that this is Audrey, and everyone believes that Audrey has to kill him in order to bring the troubles to an end, something that is kind of part of a larger twist, you know, he's kind of doing everything possible to avoid it. And meanwhile, Duke is... reeling from having to kill his own brother, and, you know, he very kind of self-indulgently, but in a way somewhat honestly, points out, hey, you're not making these sacrifices, but everybody else is. How many people are dying because of this situation when your one death could avoid all of this suffering? And he's got a bit of a point, even though he is really trying to convince himself that he can be the kind of self-involved and self-centered jerk that he was in the first season. And he's clearly not that person anymore. But, you know...
And it's opposite from when he jumped out at the beginning of the season, when they wanted to kill Nathan right off the bat to begin with.
Right, exactly. And sure enough, when push comes to shove, you've got... you know, Duke basically saving Nathan's life. Now, you know, one could also say that it's like, well, technically this is not Audrey killing you, so I have to save you because Audrey has to kill you later. But I think there was a little bit more behind that. So, it was an interesting character-driven episode. What else would you bring to it, I think?
Well, you know, you have this whole, as you were talking about Duke wanting to be this, go back to his old self-centered thing. But actually, he was pretty much the hero of most of the episode. They had to go see him because of the pressure difference. And I guess Duke had experienced deep sea diving. He had access to pressure suits so that they could help to resolve the situation. He saved the little girl at the beginning as the trouble began to manifest itself. So really, you know, that, and I think, you know, he really ended up saving the day in several different ways. So here's, you know, the sort of reluctant hero guy who used to be so self-absorbed, and it was almost a mocking himself as he talks about wanting to be self-absorbed, but at the same time, he does nothing, does virtually nothing in the episode to benefit himself, but to help others. Whether, you know, as I said, for as simple as saving the little girl, to trying to almost helping to talk Nathan into getting killed to help everybody else. He's arguing for everyone else but himself. So it struck me as ironic with that. We also we talked. Where am I? No, I don't want to jump episodes as I did last time, otherwise I'll get in trouble. But Jennifer as well, her sort of role in this at the beginning is, you know, she's still acting, I don't know if oracle is the right word, but she's still that person that's seeing trouble happen ahead of itself. Just like when she was sort of hearing things from the barn, now she's starting to see these, you know, these creatures pop up, and then the Teagues start talking about them. So, you know, as much as you want to say, oh, is her trouble not manifesting itself anymore? You know, almost in a way, it still is. She's still being sort of this magnet for the oncoming trouble or the oncoming issue that's developing.
Hmm. Yeah, her role is still unclear, but I have a feeling it's going to become a little bit more important as time goes by. But yeah, I'm still not exactly sure what is going on with her. I guess for me, the one weakness of this episode that kind of, it didn't really do too much to hurt the episode, but it was something I could nitpick a little bit, was just the way that the whole prophecy thing was, or the old journal from the first round of Troubles was revealed.
You mean like they just found it all of a sudden?
No. I thought that just the scene and the way that it was just delivered, the dialogue and everything, just felt so out of place and just kind of crappy.
you mean the delivery of it?
Yeah, it was just really bad. And I don't know if it was just that they were like, how am I supposed to say this? Because it felt just very out of place and didn't fit the tone of anything else that was going on, and it was just a little, it felt like the plot was just kind of like shoving itself into the episode a bit.
Well, you know, as we get to the end of this episode and you have, you know, have Nathan with the gun against him, I get the sense that it was almost set up for the next episode or the conclusion of this, but it almost felt like they handed them the pages minutes before shooting and just said, okay, read this, because you're right, it felt tacked on and really wasn't integral to most of the episode. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is a turn, and I guess at some point you do have to throw those turns in, and it just seemed like they were just rushing it way too fast to, okay, let's present this so we can have tension with Nathan at the end of the episode, and we can roll that right into the next episode. But it was almost an afterthought, at least that, yeah, I know what you're saying. It seemed tacked on to the episode.
That said, the information that was there was pretty interesting, because once again, it kind of feeds into my ongoing theory, but the idea that the, you know, there was this original round of troubles that was as intense as what they're dealing with now,
or more so.
Yeah, exactly. And that, you know, it really does imply that it was when the door to this other world was originally opened. And then the Barnes scenario was kind of a safety valve, almost, to that, you know, a stopgap solution that was the best they could come up with. And yeah, to me, it's like, okay, so how then does that translate into, you know, before, you know, if you don't open up the door again, if you have, you know, her kill him or whatever else, it's going to work out okay, but if the door does open again, you really don't want to do that. Like, it just, the idea is there, but there are aspects of it that are just still a little bit plot conveniency to me. And that it didn't take a lot away from the episode. I don't want to give that impression, but it was just it felt like it was a little inelegant how they shoved that exposition in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a bad it's a great concept, but it's, yeah, the way that they introduced it was poorly done. And I almost think of that when they talk about that, it's almost like there's a lock on a door, and, you know, if you lock it while the door is closed, it'll stop all the trouble, you know, stop the problems from that other dimension. But if you lock the door while it's open, it won't close again.
Yeah.
So at least that's sort of my mentality on it.
Yeah, you're going to make it even harder to close because now it's locked in position. So, yeah. In a way, that's a good way. So this particular episode, I gave an 8 out of 10. What would you give it, do you think?
Oh, no, I'm right there with you. As we were talking, I thought the trouble of the week was really interesting. And as you said, the scope of it, I didn't quite give enough. I guess I didn't give enough thought to it. I would have assumed they had evacuated. But given the scene with Duke, obviously, no, they did not really have a chance to evacuate, at least not in any large way. So, yeah, there must be dozens, if not hundreds, of people dead right now on top of everything else going on. So, it was really traumatic. And while I agree the execution was sloppy, I thought the introduction of the way to possibly save Nathan's life was an interesting twist. Just they needed to plant the seeds a little earlier in the episode.
Yes. Okay, well, since we can go ahead and move right on to the next episode, we are going to. And let's go ahead and run the promo.
Friday on an all-new Haven. An old friend.
William?
Did something happen to me?
Brings a whole new kind of crazy.
Don't play games with me. Something is very wrong.
You don't tell me the truth, I'm gonna cut it out of you.
This is all kind of terrifying.
Haven, an original series, all new this Friday at 10, only on Sci-Fi. Imagine greater.
All right, and that is Haven Season 4, Episode 9, William. The fate of Haven lies in Audrey figuring out what the mysterious thugs from the barn are still doing in town, but first she needs to rescue William from their clutches. Or does she?
I was just glad to see Colin Ferguson again, but I don't think I like him mean.
Yeah. And that, once again, you know, I keep coming back to, I have this theory about who Audrey really is and where she really comes from, and this episode by the end just was like really, really starting to point that out, you know, point right to that theory as being potentially true, and I was kind of happy to see that because it seems to me that whoever William really is, his name is not really William, at least that's what I get out of it.
Yes.
And he's tapped into whatever energy or other source of, I don't even know, matter that is kind of fueling and has been fueling the troubles from day one, or at least it can enhance the troubles, because now you kind of get the sense of why it is that controlling the trouble in the previous episode was so difficult and escalated to the point of killing so many people. He's helping these things along, and he's using whatever this substance is to enhance the troubles that are going on. So, yeah, it's definitely very interesting, but it definitely feels like to me that, based on my theory at least, that Audrey is from the other world, from my point of view, that he kind of corroborates that idea to some extent. That she and that he, the two of them used to be.
Well, that they have a connection, yeah.
Yeah, he wanted her, and maybe she volunteered to stay behind out of some disagreement that they had, and this is that now coming back to, you know, into fruition, because this is apparently, if one is to take the previous episode's revelations to heart, this is the first time in a long time that the troubles have been this intense. And part of it is that the barn system fell apart. Thanks to Nathan. You know, I could almost see that when something went wrong with the connection that the way station that the barn represented, that it opened up a way for William and his followers to come into that in-between space and then follow Audrey back when she went back to our world. So, yeah, it definitely, whatever the Barnes absence may have given us some kind of concern that there wouldn't be a way to explain much. No, it seems like they have definitely set things up so that you've got William and his people to kind of step in and explain things regardless of what's going on with the barn. And boy, if this sounds confusing to people who don't watch Haven, that's because, yeah, there's a lot of mythology that's just being dropped into all of this.
It's a little confusing to those of us that do watch Haven. Yeah. You know, they're basically sort of shaking up the whole trouble rules that we've been used to from the get-go. So, you know, there's that. As we were talking about the last episode of this show, they threw this sort of really 90-degree twist into it along the way as well. So I almost get the sense where that they're running on the fly a little bit too. I mean, the writers themselves trying to piece this together.
Yeah, this has the feeling of that maybe this is stuff that they had in kind of in their mythology, in their explanations that they've been working with for a while. I certainly get that sense when thinking back on some of the statements that they made during the panel at New York Comic Con. But that being said, it feels like they are having a little bit of trouble figuring out how to drop all of this into the story in a way that isn't completely a mess. I think they did it better than they did in the previous episode. But it is a little bit confusing because they are still kind of letting the audience fill in some of the blanks themselves. So, that said, there were a lot of interesting things going on here. I especially like how, while we've seen this trope of the inner fears and thoughts of characters coming, you know, kind of manifesting, we've seen that before. But what I liked about it is that even though people were seeing certain things being said or done by other people, it wasn't entirely clear whether or not those feelings were just manifestations of people's subconscious or unconscious concerns or doubts, self-doubt, or they were actually reading into the body language of what people actually did think. And so even when people were reacting, you didn't really know, was it just something that they drummed up in their own head or not? You know, like Jennifer and her concerns that everybody thought that she was completely crazy and deserved to be in a mental institution. Well, maybe there is some truth to that. Maybe they are concerned about her stability, but is that, you know, how does it all fit together? Because there were certain scenes where it actually felt like people were admitting that they did, in fact.
I thought they all had bits of truth in them. They weren't totally unfounded coming from nowhere, but they just really were amped up what might be a minor little issue.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not this kind of thing that, hopefully the writers won't completely drop it, because there are some implications that I think need to be explored. But we're also getting towards the end of the season, so I don't know. I guess we'll find.
I don't know how much more exploration we'll get. So, although that being said, I was glad those little mind control devices, or I was glad they weren't bugs. I sort of like that they were these, you know, powerful floating things. It gives a sense that these powers that the other dimension or otherworldly people have are more than we realize. You know, even from the last episode when they were explaining how these people can give troubles, you know, it sort of gives them a sense of power that you really feel like Audrey, Nathan, we're all the underdogs. All the Haven residents are really fighting an uphill battle because these people have so many powers and can do so much stuff.
Yeah, it almost it really does make me wonder, what the heck did they do? I mean, back in the day. I mean, and how did they do it? To open this doorway, I mean, it's classic Stephen King, right? I mean, actually more Lovecraft in a certain sense. But it's like, okay, how did they do this? And then how did it become something that became so ingrained in the residents of the town that it became a genetic trait? That whatever this weird, dark matter is, it's kind of interstitial to their DNA now, so that it can be passed down from generation to generation. What the genesis was, you know.
Oh yeah, although I mean, as they were saying how they can make these, you know, give people troubles and threatening people with them. It makes you, I was almost hoping for a flashback so we could see the original Haven as this stuff was happening. As we're sort of seeing the tail end of the current Trouble system, I'm still sort of curious to see that front end. And I'd hope that that book that they had revealed the previous episode would have gone into it a little bit more to talk about the early Trouble, so to speak. But they really didn't go that much further in the second episode with it.
I have this feeling that that's something that they want to leave until almost the last few episodes. Like, okay, you know, we're going to build up to the final resolution of the whole problem of the Troubles themselves, and it's going to tie into how it started. But I guess we'll have to see. There's always the ongoing concern when it comes to sci-fi: just how long is Haven going to be able to go? I've been just slightly concerned that we haven't had any news about Haven season 5. And we're towards the tail end, or getting close to the final third of season 4.
Well, how are their ratings?
Pretty much the same as they've ever been.
Okay, well.
You know, not spectacular, but for a Friday night, certainly not
reasonable,
bad.
Yeah.
But, you know, the longer it goes,
the more expensive it gets.
Exactly. And 5 seasons is still the top kind of cap when it comes to a sci-fi series. And lately they've been kind of, well, as we saw with Warehouse 13, they are cagey when it comes to giving a full season, even with a show that has higher ratings. So we'll...
Oh, and Eureka, too, they killed, too. You know? So it's even popular shows, they hit that mark and they're killing them anyway.
Yeah, they just can't sustain it. So, hopefully they are aware of that. But at any rate, I give this one an 8 out of 10, once again. What would you give it?
I'm going to give it a 7. Honestly, the people being possessed trope, at least so many of them, wore a little thin for me. If it had been one or two people, I think I would have liked it better. But to have so many people affected by it got to be a little bit much. It was almost hokey. It's like, oh, gosh, oh, wait, okay, so you don't want that. You think this is happening to you. You think that's happening to you. Everybody's yelling at Audrey. I was like, it was a little bit much. So I'm going to go with the 7.
Okay. Fair enough. All right, and let's see then. We are, that's it for our discussion of Haven. Sorry, I'm trying to control my mic gain right now. But at any rate, we're going to switch gears completely. You know, those were not bad episodes. They were, you know, a bit above average. I don't know that we can say that for the next show that we're going to talk about. No, not at all. And this will be Edmund's chance to jump back into the episode.
Absolutely, ready and waiting.
All right, so let's go ahead and run the promo for the latest episode of Homeland.
You killed 219 Americans.
I got plans for you.
Neighbor security camera picked it up.
I hope they nail your ass to the wall.
Because this is just the kind of human intelligence that led to disaster.
And you still haven't asked. Who moved the bomb?
Maybe I already know the answer to that.
Maybe you don't.
This is once-in-a-lifetime operation that can transform everything.
All right, and that would be Homeland, Season 3, Episode 7. How do I say this? Gerontian? Gerontian? Whatever.
You're on your own on this one.
Yeah. I don't know that it matters. With his old adversary in custody, Saul makes the gamble of his career. Meanwhile, Carrie and Quinn scramble to contain a local police investigation, and Mira comes to a crossroad in her marriage. Okay. Well, here's one thing before we get to the moment that was both the best and worst thing about the episode. But here's something that I don't quite understand, and Edmund, you might know this better, because this is certainly more your genre than mine, and you've probably seen more films and TV shows and read more books about espionage and so forth. When, let's say, something like what happened in the last episode were to take place, even if an agent somehow gets photographed as being present at a crime scene, if the CIA in general just happens to contact the local police department and say, this is a matter of national security, back off, they might not be happy about it, but are they going to really insist that somebody go and confess to the killing? I didn't get that
not really.
At all. I had absolutely no idea what was going on there. It felt
I mean, on a couple of different levels. I mean, in the first place, it was like, yes, you know, given this absurdly brutal nature of the second killing, I was really wondering if that was going to be the catalyst for them saying, you know, we really have to hang this on somebody. And there is this little thing that, yes, I know things have gotten blurred a little bit post 9/11 and Patriot Act and all that, but, you know, I'm pretty sure that there's still that stricture about the CIA not operating in the U.S. And so I'm not sure that, you know, yes, offering up one of your agents to confess to it and then have it all sort of covered over by national security really makes any sense at all.
Yeah.
So I mean that whole thing just did not hold together. I mean, okay, you know, okay, gave Rupert Friend, you know, he had to try and sort of salvage it with that line about the wrong crime, right confession, or whatever it was. It was good for him to finally confess to all these horrible things he'd done, and I guess specifically killing the kid at the very beginning of the season. That whole setup, other than, you know, as I mentioned at the top, giving me much pleasure to see Clark Johnson, who's already directed a couple of episodes this season, actually, you know, have that fun little bit of stunt casting of him playing the Baltimore homicide detective, just like he did for all those years on Homicide. And it also gave me a wonderful, personal reinterpretation of that whole scene when Carrie's getting interviewed by him and gets sick to his stomach, because since I really want to have any excuse not to acknowledge that she's actually pregnant, that was her just looking at Clark Johnson and realizing, oh my God, yes, you've played a real detective on a show that didn't tank after a season and a half, and oh, I just feel sick to my stomach right now. That just felt really strange and awkward the way they were playing out the whole investigation, and it just really made no sense to have, if they're going to have Quinn go in, I really thought it was going to be because the cops are going to insist that they had to charge him or something, but no, it's just no, we want to see a face, and then we're just going to let you brush it all under the carpet.
Yeah, that was the part that really didn't make any sense to me. It's okay. Number one, would they? Yes, I understand that the CIA is not supposed to operate in the U.S., but let's be real here. Beyond that, again, I don't get why there would be this kind of push for someone to confess to it, and then especially when it's absolutely clear through the whole nonsense that at the end of the day, it's still going to be swept under the rug, regardless of what the confession or explanation is. So it's completely meaningless. And if they wanted to tie it to the character having these guilt trips over what happened earlier in the season, maybe a reference or flashback to that event might have been helpful, considering that the other major plot points have so totally gone out of just out of control, to the point where I don't even think it resembles the beginning of the season anymore. I didn't remember that until you just brought it up. So clearly they didn't make the connection very well. I love the fact that the recap mentions Saul and his marriage, because that was, what, three scenes? Between this episode and the last episode? Kinda. And any hope that... Well, okay. The hope that Carrie's pregnancy is just some kind of strange side effect and psychological thing going on is now undermined slightly by her having nausea issues, which could be psychosomatic, but now they're really digging a deeper hole with that. if it does turn out to be that that's the explanation, it just is going to be even more Clay. But
and as I said, that's why I had to start coming up with alternate theories of what she's saying.
Yes. Yes, she's still crazy after all these years. Okay, but here we go. Here's the thing that I was laughing hysterically as it was going on, both because it was genuinely a funny scene, but also was so absurd that how are we supposed to take it seriously? And that's Saul and Dar completely trolling Senator Lockhart.
Yes.
Basically, so number one, you know, Lockhart is kind of playing the audience at this point. Really, he is. As much of a jerk as he's being, because he's sitting there saying, Saul, so your entire plan to kind of turn this agent or turn this asset from the Iranian intelligence organization against the Iranians involved taking one of your best agents and raking her over the coals and through the mud.
Yeah.
Voluntarily. And you're sitting
humping
there
her full of drugs.
Yeah, just basically destroying her. And you're sitting there with this cat who ate the canary grin on your face. Just admitting that, yeah, that was the plan. Didn't I do a good job? Isn't that great? Look what we did. Yeah, dude, you destroyed Carrie. What's wrong with you? What? Why was that a problem? It's like, what? And then they make him out as if he completely doesn't get what's going on. When, I'm sorry, as a member of the audience, I'm sitting there thinking, no, he's got a point.
Yeah.
And then he comes right out and says, stop the operation. I'm going to make sure this stops. You're done. And then Saul and Dar just basically trick him into locking himself into a conference room.
Yeah.
And then they mock him by turning the light off and cutting communications and all but thumbing their nose at him. And the whole time I'm sitting there thinking, all you're doing is making him more pissed off, so when he gets out, he's even more inclined to shut you down. This accomplishes nothing. This in no way stops him from shutting you down. What's the point? That you're like 10-year-olds? And then they toast each other for it.
Exactly. I mean, just when I was sort of having some hope, I mean, especially given the fact that it's, you know, it's Mandy Patinkin and F. Murray Abraham, that, you know, they were setting the two of them up to be, you know, to be sort of be in, you know, in conflict and trying to undercut each other, you know, for the second half of the season, because I thought that would be kind of fun. Then it gets completely turned on its head, and it's like, oh, Saul, yes, you know, you're such a fabulous good old boy, going back to the, you know, the tried and true methods, just like I like. Especially after that setup, I mean, it just really made no sense. But as we keep saying, there's a lot of stuff that isn't making sense on Homeland right now.
How does that work? I don't get it. I can't wrap my head around it. It's how do they think that this is going to accomplish anything positive?
Yeah, I mean, you know, okay, he's cleared airspace, so you can let him out now, and it's like, okay.
So here's the thing, right? So you've just been told that the person who's going to be in control and has the far more support from the top brass and from the executive branch, right? That he doesn't want this to keep going, and he's going to do everything in his power to stop it from continuing. Okay, so now you've got this guy that's about to go on this plane. He's a huge information source on the Iranian intelligence community. You've got really two choices. Number one, actually do what this senator wants, since he's going to kind of be your boss, unless you're planning to quit, which Saul doesn't have a life, as we've kind of found out. If you want to maintain any hope of staying in this CIA, you're going to have to kind of be nice to the new guy. So why not, make a phone call and make sure he doesn't get on the plane, because it's clear that, the operation is pretty much dead. In any realistic world, anyway. Or you can go ahead and let him get on the plane, having been worked over by the CIA, only to find that because the new guy is going to cancel the operation, that there's no follow-through whatsoever, and you've just basically given ammunition to one of the top Iranian guys it's a leak that the CIA did all of this stuff. When the CIA is pretty much in danger of being shut down.
Mm-hmm.
This is a completely no-win situation. The way that it's set up.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, of course, we're also just kind of glossing over the fact of, you know, no, this seems like a kind of silly operation in the first place.
Right. And meanwhile, you know, this guy is so canny that he basically knows this whole thing is thrown together with spit and tackle, and he knows that he can pretty much play carry the whole way.
Yeah, I mean, techniques,
I know something you don't know. That's all it takes. Right, that's
yes,
it.
Indeed. Yeah, well, and not to mention, I mean, in terms of, you know, advancing the story, it's like, yeah, so he's confirmed that, Brody did not drive the van there. It's like, yes, but we already knew that.
Right, and she did too, so why is she determined. So shocked? She was there!
Yeah.
She even admitted she knows, and then it's like, what? He did? You know who did it? Well, of course, it wasn't him.
Yes.
Oh, just one thing after another. But I will admit that the look of glee on Saul's face when he turned the lights off, it was funny.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
It was hilarious, but it was just hilarious because
completely
gonzo.
Childish and non-physical.
Oh, it definitely, this show has just gone off the rails in such a spectacular way. And there's still, what, 5 episodes left?
Oh, something like that. I think we're barely over halfway.
So, I mean, if they don't have this whole operation pretty much deep-sixed in the first 5 minutes of the next episode, then it's just throw your hands up. It's all credibility lost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I just keep thinking, like, this, what show is this? Because it's not the same show as the first season. At all. This is nothing like that. This is just way different. And
well, I guess the Emmy Awards will be wide open next year.
That'll be the thing. The critics are still going to just love this to death. And I don't know why, because it just is incomprehensible. I give this a 5, and I still feel like that was almost being generous. But at least they were trying the actors.
Yeah,
that was kind of my. How about you?
Yeah, I think on that basis, I can agree with the 5.
It at least made us laugh.
Yeah.
Okay. Because
yeah.
I still think it was a little bit better than the previous one, but not by much.
Not by much at all. But it's. Yeah, I will give it this. I mean, as you say, I mean, the decline has been so spectacular that it is still entertaining just to see how absurd it's going to get.
Yes, and it still ranks as being the most precipitous drop that we've had ever between two seasons of a given show. We're now looking at a 1.6 point score drop, and there's still quite a bit to go.
Yeah.
It's special. Okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead then and perhaps switch gears. Let's go ahead and do our midpoint break. I think we need one after that to get our heads back where they belong. And then we'll go on to the quick hits for this week. Stay tuned.
So what'd you really think of that show? Because
well,
I did crack up when I saw the episode title for the previous
yes.
Evisceration.
Yeah, you liked that? Yes, for those who may have missed it, we actually did title that episode John and Edmund Rip Apart Homeland. So, yeah, that was special. Okay, let's go ahead then and move into our quick hits as promised. And I think that this will probably turn out to be a little bit better. And Gary, why don't you go ahead and do the first one here?
Absolutely. We're talking about Sleepy Hollow, Season 1, Episode 7, The Midnight Ride. Abby gets a surprise visit from Andy. Hidden clues are sought by Ichabod and Abby to thwart the evil in Sleepy Hollow. Oh, that still sounds pretty generic. Let's see. Just to cut to the end quick, Henry reviewed it, and he gave it an 8. Sleepy Hollow's, I thought it's been running a pretty good season, honestly. They've really broken out of the single horseman theory early on and expanded it out, and they're keeping it pretty fresh and interesting. I recently caught up on most of the episodes, and I'm really enjoying it. They're mixing it up enough. The characters aren't quite the stereotypical tropes that I expected them to be, and it's going pretty good. Are either one of you watching this show right now?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I think they're doing a really good job, and the main character's really grown on me a lot.
Yeah, Edmund, how about you? How did you like this episode?
Yeah, no, I've really been enjoying it as well, and I thought this was some interesting twists going on. As Gary said, the way they managed to expand it, a bit beyond the single horseman, and and certainly bringing in the four horsemen. And I was actually rather surprised how they brought the horsemen back and immediately wiped out what the Masons, who looked like they were going to be a nice little extra support and some new members of the team and. But then did a rather nice job of still managing to trap him on their own. So I've been really enjoying it, and they've been doing a really good job of building those main characters and turning them into people who you are really starting to care about. And also an interesting twist with the way they've been using Andy and bringing him back and starting to make it a little unclear of exactly which side he's on or what game he's playing here. So some good stuff, and I'd say definitely one of the nice surprises of the new shows this season. And ratings wise, I would agree with Henry on the 8.
Yeah, this was a fun one. I mean, it ended in a way that I really didn't expect it to. And like you were saying, Gary, I just really enjoy this particular main character. He cracks me up. They completely, sell to me this idea that he was basically involved in every single possible thing that you could imagine from the Revolution. And yet, it still just works. Because they don't even try to explain away how this could possibly be the case. They just kind of go with it. And I think that that's probably the thing that is working with this show, is that, it's a bit ridiculous when you stop and think about it, but they just approach it with this sense of total confidence and in what they're doing. Not to say that it's like, we believe that this actually is, going on or anything like that, but more along the lines of, we're going to sell this particular show and this concept, and we're going to play it straight. And we're just...
Well, yeah, exactly. They're taking themselves seriously.
Yes, exactly. It's like, we're just going to do this as, and we're not going to play coy with the audience or anything like that. We're just going to act like this is perfectly normal. And yep, this guy was involved in, every little thing in the Revolutionary War. Yep. What's the problem? Of course he was.
I'm waiting to find out when he cracked the Liberty Bell. But
But you know what? They'll play it off as, yep, that's the way it was. Next.
He was visiting Philadelphia, and...
it's almost a... you guys remember, by any chance, the Highlander series that was in syndication back when Babylon 5 was on?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Oh, the one that Claudia Christian was in, yes.
Yeah.
And Lockley was in... Yeah.
And you know, it's...
No, there was only one. I don't remember. Sorry.
Well, no, I was going to say, never mind that the series was better than pretty much any of the sequels to the movie, as far as relatively true to the concept, but this almost feels like taking some of the elements of that show and actually doing it a bit better. And because really, I mean, you've got this guy that has this history and you flash back to him involved in all these historical things, but they play it completely straight. But it feels a lot less contrived because of the way that they're doing it. And then he'll make these little comments about, you know, dealing with the internet, and that was absolutely priceless.
My personal favorite one was when they were buying the detective was buying bottled water, and he's just utterly flummoxed. What do you mean? Why don't you just drink it out of a tap or go to the lake and take a? It's like, you don't want to do that. You don't even want to know what's in that lake. So,
let me drink my water that I got from the fountain outside. Along with all the arsenic. It stares down the water glass. It's it's just, you know, it is ridiculous, but yeah.
Yeah, that was one thing just one last thing I wanted to mention was I do like the way they've been handling the sort of fish out of water, man out of time stuff, you know, without being, you know, trite about it or cliched about it. And this is going back a few episodes, but I think the moment that really turned that for me was that episode that opened with him having that conversation in the car, and it turns out being the heart to heart with the OnStar roadside assistance lady in the mirror.
I thought that was
Yeah. And, you know, and then from this episode, they haven't been relying, you know, this is, I think, one of the first times they've sort of hit on that, you know, when the tour guide is spouting off all that stuff about Paul Revere and he starts trying to correct.
Yes, that was good, too. And just, you know, just...
Or just shakes his head.
He was, doing the thing with the OnStar person in the previous episode, and then in this one, he's leaving the extra formal voicemails for Abby.
Yes.
I am, as always, sincerely yours, Ichabod Crane. I almost want to start doing that for voicemail at work, just for fun. It just strikes me as, it's just very good. And then you get all that comedic stuff going on, only to have in the final act some genuinely tense and scary moments with the horsemen in the sewers.
Oh, yeah.
That reminded me almost like the tension that we were talking about in our previous show with The Walking Dead, and in that recent episode, and it was just their ability to switch the genres up in the same show like that almost seamlessly is another reason why I agree with the 8. And I think that this show, despite the ridiculousness of the concept, is actually working. But you know, I have to say that's kind of a hallmark of these writers and these producers to have these scripts that don't really hold up to very tight scrutiny, but the characters work, and sometimes it just gels. Gary, what would you give this one, do you think?
Oh, no, I'm going to give it an 8 there. They're developing things and, you know, tying off different knots, even doing the unexpected, which is nice. I thought this was going to be a very, a trope episode, but they keep mixing it up. I like it a lot.
Okay. Let's see, Evan, if you could take the next one.
Absolutely. This would be American Horror Story Coven season 3, episode 5. Burn, Witch, Burn. Zoe unleashes a new power. Meanwhile, Fiona and Myrtle battle for control of the Coven. And this was the follow-on to their zombie-tastic Halloween episode. And have you caught up, John?
I have not. As I've been away, and I was already behind.
Okay. Just so I know how much to reveal or not reveal. This was just a continuing their strong arcs. Bringing the council in and having Fiona being basically brought up on charges of incompetence and not running things properly, which they've certainly been building up in the first few episodes, and Fiona very nicely turning the tables and leading up to a fiery end, which you really might not have been expecting in this day and age. And but Fiona definitely gets her revenge. They did a nice job mixing it in with the flashbacks to when the young Fiona was becoming the Supreme, and this rivalry with Myrtle was sort of its roots were being sown. And this was just again a very, very strong episode, and I've been having a lot of fun with this show, and looking forward to what's coming, and I'm really debating whether or not I'm going to go back and take a look at some of the earlier stuff with all I hear about its inconsistencies, but then again, I know not to expect that it's going to be this good, but I am just kind of intrigued now to see, you know, where they were coming from with those other different stories they started out with. So Nadim gave this an 8 out of 10, and I think I would definitely agree with that.
Okay. And Gary, the next one, please.
Sure. We're talking about Scandal, Season 3, Episode 6, Icarus. Olivia's team continues to work with Josie, whom Cyrus and Melly scheme to take down. Meanwhile, Harrison's loyalties are tested, and Olivia has to make a crucial choice that will impact all of her White House relationships. Nadim rated this very highly at 9, and I think he's generally liked this season, so it's been getting good press and decent ratings from what I hear, and ABC's always pimping it, so I think it's doing well. Do you follow this show at all, John?
No, I do not.
Okay.
But certainly this is one of Nadim's favorites, and all I do is hear people talking about this show, so it seems to have kind of taken up the zeitgeist that Grey's Anatomy once held, and certainly it's the same producer, so that makes a certain amount of sense. All right, let's see, moving on then to the next one, and that would be, it would be appropriate for me to take this one, The Vampire Diaries, Season 5, Episode 6, Handle with Care. Silas announces his new goal to Damon and Elena. Tessa tells Stefan about her next move. Catherine discovers an unexpected consequence of being human and realizes she needs a new place to stay. Bonnie is touched by Jeremy's determination to stand by her. Damon is stunned when he learns the secret to Tessa's plan. This was actually a pretty good episode from my standpoint. I enjoyed it quite a bit. This has always been a show where you've got people who are quote-unquote doppelgangers of each other across time and sometimes type of being, and that is kind of expanding a bit in these first few episodes of Season 5, almost to the point where it's becoming Fringe-esque in how there are different versions of the same person, kind of, played by, of course, the same actor or actress, so it's giving the cast an opportunity to really stretch and show their range, and sometimes it allows them to kind of branch out from what is their primary, more dour and somewhat angsty character and play someone with a bit more verve, so to speak. Catherine, of course, being the example I always give for Nina Dobrev, because Elena is kind of always angsty, but Catherine is the saucy, sexy one. And this particular season, they've had Stefan, who is annoyingly dour almost all the time, has the doppelganger of Silas, who is deliciously evil. So, it's been a lot of fun. This episode, I gave an 8 out of 10 for that reason. And, yeah, it's been fun. Gary, you said you caught up with Grimm, I think, so why don't you go ahead and take that one for us?
Absolutely. We're talking about Grimm Season 3, Episode 3, A Dish Best Served Cold. Nick and Hank investigate a series of gruesome crime scenes that may be linked to an old feud. Meanwhile, Nick enjoys his newfound health, and Monroe and Rosalie discuss taking their relationship to the next level. This was sort of nice. We had this sort of growing storyline, or at least tying up from last season a little bit, and we sort of got a break from it, in a sense, with this one, and we went back to a classic Vessin problem that needed solving. At least that was the bulk of this story. I thought it worked really well, and yes, they talk about it being a gruesome crime scene, and yeah, people's stomachs were literally exploding. Two different groups of Vessins that have been historical enemies, the weaker one got the upper hand by serving basically bad food to the first group, and it heated up both sides, and it was about ready to break out into a whole war, but Nick figured out a way to sort of force the hand of the chef in this case, who was causing all the problems, and resolved it in a nice manner. I thought it worked out well. As far as Monroe and Rosalie, they're going to move in together. I had almost thought they were moved in together already, so it sort of took me by surprise that was happening. But nevertheless, we still have some background scenes going with this whole royal child issue and things like that. But overall, I'm really liking the show. They just keep getting better. It's not an over-the-top better, but it's just a little increment where things get a little bit more polished, the stories get a little bit more interesting. So I really like this season a lot. It continues to do well, at least in my opinion. And I'm going to give it a 9. I thought it was really good. I thought it handled the traditional Grimm with some added-on stuff as well. So I liked it a lot. I'll go with the 9.
Yeah, this was a nice kind of return back to a character-driven episode after the really big season-ending, season-premiere arc that they had with the zombies. This was kind of getting back to the I guess you could say some of the things that they had introduced back in the first season that were just kind of in the background. And one thing that I've always liked is the fact that Monroe is such a unique character among his own kind anyway, because he's kind of given up the carnivorous life, and yet he is also obviously very much one of his community, and for people that he knows to be getting killed in this extremely gruesome way because of this ongoing centuries-long feud, it was nice for them to touch back on that element that was kind of introduced in the first season, and yet also show how much the characters have grown since then. And I even liked Renard coming along and really challenging Nick about the fact that, okay, it's one thing when people are in danger, but you act differently when it's the Vessin in danger. And it's like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I saw he was making that point, but at the same time, you know, I always had the sense that Grimm's, while he is friends with Vessin now, you know, Grimm's never really considered Vessin to be equals. You know, I think about when his mother came to visit, and she just slaughters him left and right. She could care less. So, you know, it was interesting that, you know, that Renard is trying to ground him a little bit to some extent when it comes to the Vessin. But, you know, typically a Grimm doesn't do that. So it's interesting that he's trying to make Nick see the light, so to speak, that Vessin need to be treated equally and fairly and not just as cannon fodder.
Well, I mean, that plays into the larger context, too, because, you know, one thing that they've been doing is really emphasizing the fact that Renard is working with the Resistance because the royal families have been, you know, kind of tyrannical, including his own family, and he's kind of the bastard of the family. He's got reason to want to bring his own family down. But the royals have also suborned, to some extent, the Grimms, and they're working together to kind of roll it over the rest of the Vessin community. So, in a way, Renard is trying to cultivate Nick as a resource or someone to work with as a part of this resistance, not just to change up things as far as the royal family's control over the Vessin community, but then also to change who the Grimms are and to maybe make them be a benevolent control over the Vessin community versus this thing to be feared that they had become and then were kind of corrupted by the power that was handed to them. But what I like is the fact that you can take something like that scene and Renard's motivations and how they have now fleshed out the world enough that all these implications do become apparent. And now this show has that depth to it, because this is what was missing in the first season. This is what, you know, he didn't have a team around him, and they were really referring to a bunch of things that had no context. Well, now they do, and it makes the difference when it comes to a show like this. So yeah, I was happy with it. I gave it an 8. I didn't quite get to the 9, but Grimm is one of those shows that I really look forward to and enjoy, because it's kind of become that, you know, initially the show was not quite as on the ball as Once Upon a Time was, but it has reversed drastically over the last couple of years, that's for sure. Let's see. I'll go ahead and do the next one. The Good Wife, Season 5, Episode 7. The next week, Alicia and Carrie suspect that Lockhart Gardner is spying on them when Zach discovers that the webcam on Alicia's computer is being accessed remotely. Meanwhile, Will gets more than he bargained for when he helps one of Alicia's former clients, and Clark Hayden returns to offer financial advice to Flora Agos. Henry gave this one a 9. Certainly this game-changing season continues to get a lot of praise from a lot of people. I haven't been quite up on it because, again, unfortunate timing of a business travel, but there we go. It happens. But no, it seems like this season just keeps swimming along. And Edmund, why don't you go ahead and round us out?
Sure, and I will just comment on The Good Wife, that given the network it's on, I know who I would suspect of looking in on their webcam, but we'll be talking about that later in the week.
She needs to know.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Grumble, don't watch the show, grumble, but still.
All right, last one.
All right, so last one is Revenge, Season 3, Episode 7, Resurgence. Conrad wants to polish the tarnished Grayson name, so he hires a reformed party gal who's transformed into a savvy PR expert. Meanwhile, Emily intensifies her commitment to her plan, and Nolan works on a personal plot of vengeance. And Nadine gave this a dead average 7 out of 10. And I know I've been hearing rumblings elsewhere on the interwebs that people are not so happy with what's happening with Revenge, but I guess for Nadine, at least they were at least doing okay this time.
Yes, he's been kind of skeptical of where they're going as well. My understanding is that this is a show where the first season was very much a popular show, maybe the flavor of the moment, and then the second season was very much not in the liking of many people, and then the third season, everyone was wondering where the show was going to go, and it started off pretty well, and now it's going back in the direction of the second season, and a lot of people not too happy with that.
Did the writers just run out of ideas?
To me, it sounded like the whole thing had one idea from the beginning, so you're asking the wrong person. All right, well, those are the quick hits for this week, and on our next show, of course, someone will be covering, I'm not sure exactly who, but someone will be covering Supernatural, Person of Interest, and Arrow, and I guess we'll find out whether or not those shows were able to meet the usual high standards that we hold them to. We'll leave that to a little bit of mystery. I can think of one that probably is, but I'm not sure about the other two. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there's also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for the show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...